what earlier didn't, so they have to change batteries. All right, let me first see what's in the previous chapter that you want to discuss and then go on to intellectual property. So start out with just property, where I guess the two central issues, though not the only two, were what's in the bundle, which is sort of a Coasean answer, and then the one that's more relevant to what we're doing next, which is why does it make sense for some things to be property and some things to be commons? What are the both advantages and costs of treating something as property? So did you have questions on either of those areas that you wanted to discuss? No. All right. No. Yes. Maybe. Speak quickly. All right. Then let me talk about intellectual property. And again, let me start by seeing if you have questions on what you read. Then I want to go through the sort of quick summary of the law, because I think most of you haven't had IP law, I gather. And I'm hardly an expert, but I at least know something about it. And then go through the economics, and then discuss more than the book discusses about the current situation vis-a-vis digital intellectual property and the internet and stuff like that, which I didn't know as much about when I wrote that book, because some of it hadn't happened yet. Note, by the way, that the book was written in the 20th century, and therefore, or at least, I don't know if it was published in the 20th century, but at least when I refer to things early in this century, I mean early in the 20th, not early in the 21st. I noticed that going through the text today. Thought it might confuse some people, especially as the years go by. All right, so any questions about what you've read for today? Yes?
I guess you're telling you might get it to near the end, but it seems that, especially now, it kind of is, the chapter previous, just property, and then the intellectual property, where now there seems to be a lot of the combining of the two, where you have a copyright on some sort of physical object that you own, or a copyright of the stuff inside the physical object that you own, that is just the stuff you can do with the physical object.
Isn't that, in a sense, always true? If you think you own a book, it's a physical object, and the copyright means you can't photocopy it.
Right, but I guess in some sense you... But
I'm wondering if you aren't thinking about licensing terms rather than copyright.
Yeah, I guess some of it's licensing terms.
Because the other thing I don't really discuss, maybe I should, is the interaction between contract and intellectual property, which has become increasingly important, I think, in the last decade or couple of decades. But...
Yeah, I guess probably more licensing, but a lot of things with the DMCA and breaking the software protections and how that's become excessively
yes.
Legal. And then, it's probably the big one that a lot of people see.
I do actually mention the DMCA, although not by name.
But like, well, a lot of it with the iPhone, where you can do whatever you want with it except for hacking, which is one of the DMCAs. Whereas with a book, you could exile the book, write stuff in on the book, you could take other people's copies or copies of pages of other books.
But you can't translate it.
But you... Oh, really? For good.
I believe that... I think it is the case that, legally speaking, if I take a book in English and translate it just on my computer into German and print out a copy for myself, I think, strictly speaking, I violated the copyright. Now, I might make a fair use defense. Certainly, if I do a translation and then publish the translation without the permission of the original, I'm violating copyright. The point at which I became aware of that a long time ago was due to my interest in medieval cooking, because I had come across a Spanish translation of a 13th century Spanish Muslim cookbook. Big cookbook, quite interesting. And I managed to get some people who knew Spanish to retranslate that into English. And for a while I was distributing it to fellow hobbyists. And I then realized that I was in violation of copyright, because the Spanish translation, this was a double translation, the Arabic original, if it had had a copyright, it would have been expired by now, because this was about 700 years old. But the Spanish translation was covered by the copyright of the translator, and therefore, a translation of that translation was covered by both copyrights, the new translator and the old translator, and since the translator, the original translator, I think, was no longer alive, and I was unable to get in to locate whoever it was, I therefore couldn't do it. Now, I solved that problem by finding somebody who actually could read 13th century cooking Arabic and having him go back to the original Arabic and do a translation with, no doubt, some help from the Spanish translation. And then I could make it available again. And I'll tell you the story, because it's a good story, even though it has nothing to do with what really we're doing now. And that is that I first got into doing medieval Islamic cooking as a result of a reference in a modern Middle Eastern cookbook by a woman called Claudia Rodin, who mentioned the existence of a different 13th century source that had been translated by a scholar back in the 1930s. And I found that and read it. Many years later, I get a letter which says, I understand you are the say source for the translation of the anonymous Andalusian cookbook by Charles Perry. Could you tell me how I can buy a copy? Signed, Claudia Rodin. So I sent her a copy with a thank you for having gotten me into doing this thing 20 years before or whatever it was. But that was sort of neat. Anyway, let's go on to... So, questions on what you read? All right, let me give my sort of brief summary to be interrupted at any point that you feel like interrupting it. And that copyright, what is protected, is supposed to be expression and not idea. And that is a distinction that is much clearer in words than when you actually try to apply it, because very often you see that what at one level is an expression, at another level is an idea. I gave the Superman example, but you can think of the same thing in lots of other contexts. If you think about a computer program where you're imitating the program but not actually copying the code, is what you're imitating the idea of a spreadsheet, say, or the expression of, I don't know, the idea of a way of keeping track of numbers or something. And there are a lot of problems of that sort. But at least in principle, if you can distinguish them, let me take the case of a recipe. It is clear that if somebody takes my medieval recipes and gets the information from them but does not copy my words, says, you know, here's how you make this dish, gives instructions in his own words, all of it based on my research and not his, he is not violating any legal right of mine. If he literally quotes it, then it becomes a question of whether it comes under fair use or not. But in principle, a straight quote of my recipe, which I have occasionally found online and complained about, without credit, that is a violation of the copyright. Which credit is still a violation of copyright? Yeah. That's a very different issue. That is, because it doesn't free you from copyright liability to give credit. And plagiarism would apply even to things not under copyright. If you plagiarize something that was, for example, written before the copyright statute or whose copyright had expired, if you were taking if you wanted to get credit for being a good writer and you found a short story written by some very good artist, a good author in 1850, not under copyright, but you're plagiarizing it. And on the other hand, if you copy a chapter of my book, and you say at the beginning, you know, this is from David Friedman's book, Law's Order, you are still violating my copyright. So they're separate issues. And in terms of norms, it's sort of interesting that as far as I can tell, the academic world, people are much more serious about plagiarism than they are about copyright violation. That it used to be the case, I think, that professors almost routinely violated copyright in the form of photocopying articles to distribute to their students. And for whatever reason, over time, the enforcement of that got tighter, and therefore nowadays you usually have to actually go to all the trouble of getting permission. I think probably many professors, myself included, feel as though it would be a net win if nobody paid me money for permission to photocopy my articles, and I didn't have to get permission from anybody to copy theirs. It's just a nuisance. But in any case, but the same people who would be pretty casual about that, most of them would take very seriously the discovery that somebody had been engaged in plagiarism. And now an interesting case in a sense, of which I can think of two high-profile examples sort of in the last 20 years, is people who aren't really academics who engage in plagiarism. Because if you think about it sort of for somebody not in that world, well, you know, what are you complaining about? It's not like somebody was hurt by it. I just took a well-expressed set of ideas and expressed them. And as you may know, there was a recent scandal in Germany when it turned out that a government minister, apparently, I don't know what the follow-up was, the claim at least was that the government minister who had a PhD had in fact plagiarized his doctoral thesis. And there was a similar flap in the U.S. somewhat earlier with less attention when it turned out that Martin Luther King had plagiarized large parts of his doctoral thesis. And it's, I sort of have mixed feelings. So on the one hand, there's a certain sense in which, from the academic standpoint, these people are fakes. They're not planning to be professional academics, and yet they're going through the process for being a professional academic. And you can see that from their standpoint, sort of jumping through hoops. Well, if you can go around the hoop and nobody notices, why not? And yet from the norms of the academic world, you know, I mean, that's much more serious than theft, murder, robbery, stuff like little pecking holes like that. I mean, nobody would think of, well, and it's unlikely that somebody who turned out to have committed theft would be barred from a university position as well, as a result, whereas any serious plagiarism might very well be. Anyway, a digression. But so what's it protected against? And the answer is that it's protected not only against direct copying, but also against derivative works. That's the translation example. And I'm not sure. I guess a film of a book would count as a derivative work, too. So that if you took somebody else's book without his permission and made it into a movie, that would be a derivative work, and that would violate his copyright. And it is not protected against independent creation, and that's an interesting difference from patent law. That in patent, there is no requirement at all that I have gotten an idea from you in order for me to be covered by your copyright. That once you have it, nobody else essentially is allowed to invent it without your permission. Copyright, traditional copyright, didn't really matter very much because there was essentially a zero chance that somebody else would actually produce the same work. But as I mentioned in the book, in the context of computer programs, it turned out that it actually did matter because there were reasons why people would end up producing the identical work without having to copy, not because they were copying it to save trouble, but because they wanted compatibility between two computers and that required that the code be very nearly identical. But it is true that in the laws that existed, in principle, independent invention was a defense against infringement, provided you could prove it. And the protection, to get copyright, essentially, literally all you have to do under current U.S. law is to write things down, or probably to save them to a computer disk. That if it is fixed in some tangible medium, I think is the technical language, it is now copyrighted. I guess it's the case that these words are now copyrighted because I'm recording them on my recorder. I think that's probably right. You can register a copyright, and registering the copyright gives you additional legal rights. And I think it is the case, and again, this isn't my field, that the essential difference is that if somebody violates an unregistered copyright, you can only claim against him for actual damages. If somebody violates a registered copyright, you can claim statutory damages, which in some cases might be much larger than actual damages. We'll actually have to show you've been hurt. But you have it even without the registration. The protection for a very long period of time, for life plus 50 years, is the current rule, and for there's a different rule for works made for hire, I don't remember, 99 years or something like that. The standard comment made by people who are critical of long copyrights is that whenever Mickey Mouse is about to go out of copyright, the Copyright Act is extended. And I don't know how nearly correct that is. It's a good line, but it is true that it's tended to be extended. And Larry Lessig, who I mentioned before, at one time engaged in what I thought was a pretty hopeless attempt to persuade the Supreme Court that extending copyright was unconstitutional. And his argument, which I thought was rather cute, was that the Constitution says for a limited time. Now, of course, 50 years plus life is a limited time. But if it's 50 years plus life, and when that expires, we'll extend it again, then he was arguing it had become de facto unlimited. But he did not sell that to the Supreme Court, not surprisingly. There are a couple of other points on copyright. The first is fair use. And fair use is a pretty fuzzy rule, where basically what it says is, here are the things that make it more likely to count as fair use. And if you have enough of them, you probably aren't infringing, even if you are infringing, so to speak. That is, you're probably not liable. But as far as I know, there isn't any formula. We can't say if you have A and B or A and C, then you're all right, because they're matters of degree. The other thing which is relevant and a little hard to define is that so far I've been talking, and much of the chapter is talking, in terms of what I think of as traditional copyright, which is basically copyrighting a book chapter or the equivalent. But copyright in recent decades has tended to expand beyond that to things like look and feel, to things like, I mentioned the case of the Lotus menu tree. Probably you may all be too young to remember Lotus 1-2-3, but it was the second dominant spreadsheet. VisiCalc was the original spreadsheet, and Lotus was the next one. And Lotus, this was before graphic interfaces were, I don't think, probably didn't exist, or at least weren't common. And so it was done basically from the keyboard, and it had a menu tree. So you still have menu trees, you have the option of a menu now as well. But its tree meant something like, you know, option S for save, option A for select all. I don't remember what all of them were. And some of those you have this, and then having chosen this, you then get a second, you know, something for format, and then I for italic or something. And a number of companies, but in particular Borman, something like that, made spreadsheets which were not copies of Lotus 1-2-3, but who copied their menu tree from Lotus 1-2-3. And the reason for that was that if somebody had trained himself with Lotus 1-2-3, he'd memorized and more or less programmed into his fingers the set of commands that did things. Therefore, having memorized that into his fingers, it was natural enough that if he used the new one, he wanted one that worked the same way. And Lotus sued on the grounds that they claimed that was copyright infringement, and the court sort of split on it. Ended up as a 4-4 failure to reverse in the Supreme Court. I don't even remember which Borland that was. Not the Supreme Court, Borland. Which side it was at that point. So it was never really very clearly determined just where the line was drawn. But it was at least arguable that that kind of thing, which I'm not sure I call an expression, it's sort of functional, was protectable. One of the things that either Borland or one of the other companies, I think Borland did, but that was sort of cute, was to offer the program with customizable menu tree. And then somebody else could offer a customizing which consisted of the Lotus menu tree. I'm not sure how that flew with the courts, but I thought it was sort of an entertaining way around. But in any case, the copyright, I think copywriting as literal copying is pretty straightforward. As you get towards more and more non-literal stuff, it's really oozing over towards what patent is supposed to cover, and it's trouble. So any questions on copyright? So you realize that all of you have copyrights. Assuming that you're writing, you're producing copyrights this very moment, assuming that you're typing something and not just browsing the web. Yeah.
Can you have a question on the clean room?
Yes. Sure. The problem is that IBM made a very successful early personal computer called the IBM PC. Other companies wanted to make computers that could run the same software. And if the courts had never decided the computer programs were copyrightable, it wouldn't have been a problem. They would just copy the software. Just copy the software that's built into the machine. Or the machine has got firmware. It's got stuff which is in the read-only memory of the machine, which is essentially controlling it. So your program says, put the number 3 into memory location of the read-only memory such and such. And the program that's booted with read-only memory says, if the number 3 appears here, take the text in such and such a memory buffer and print it out. I don't think it really does that, but that's an imaginary example. But essentially, it is a detailed low-level description of how the of the controls, of what should the description is, the controls itself. John Hersey described machine language program as a fancy CAM. CAM is, I don't know if you've ever seen, say, you have a mechanical process, this is before computers, where you want to control a machine to do something. And one way in which that was done was, I need to get some more of these things, was you have a roughly circular thing which can go around, except it's not quite circular because in various places it goes out or in. and then there's something touching against that, and when it goes out, it makes something mechanical happen. When it goes in, it makes something mechanical happen. So the version that I've actually seen is some very high-end sewing machines. If they want to embroider a pattern, they'll have plastic cams where the pattern of things on the cam is telling the needle, you know, move over here, and so forth. All right. And really, that's what a machine language program is. It's just a much more sophisticated version of that, because it's a piece of machinery, really, which is controlling the low-level stuff the computer's done. So you want to make a clone of the IBM PC, as a bunch of companies wanted to do, and you are not allowed to simply copy the machine language program that's built into its read-only memory, because that's copyright violation. But you are allowed to recreate it, as long as you don't copy it. So how do you recreate it? First, you have your team A read the software. They actually can, you know, look at the read-only memory and put on a screen what it says, and then figure out its functions. So what they are producing from the read-only memory is not a copy of the memory, but a functional description of what it does. So that functional description says, if you put this number in this memory location, such and such happens. Where that might be a number from a different memory location is put into the central processing unit in register A or something. Or it might be something more mechanical. All right? Once you have a complete description, if we can make software which for everything you do reacts in exactly the same way as the software built in, we're home free. We now have software which running the same programs will do the same things. All right? So our software doesn't have to be a precise copy. That would just be the easy way of doing it. But it's likely to be very, very close to a precise copy, because because this is very low-level function. So it matters not only what the code says, but which memory location it's at. Well, if I've got an instruction which says transfer the contents of buffer X to register A, and I know that that instruction starts at memory location 127, then in order to duplicate it, I've got to put something at starting memory location 127, which is the machine language instruction for doing that. Well, that's just what was there in the original. All right, so do that for everything, and you're going to end up with something which is going to be at least very close to an exact copy of the original code. Make sense? Having done that, so team A makes the functional description. Does not say what the software is, but it says in excruciating detail what it does. Team B then writes software that will fit that functional description. So they are, in effect, recreating the IBM PC's low-level built-into-it software without having seen it. All right? Does that make sense? Trying to think of what would be an analogous... Think of, so there ought to be a good analogy, and I'm not thinking of one. But if something, the math wouldn't do it. But if something where you've got some set of symbols, as it were, where the symbols actually do something, and you're now trying to do exactly the same thing with a new set of symbols, and it's going to be look a lot like the old set of symbols. It's damned. So the second team then writes the software. You then put it in your cloned machine. IBM sues you. And you provide the logs or photographs or videos, whatever it was, and the testimony of your people showing that the people who created that software never saw IBM's code, therefore couldn't have copied it. That's the basic essence of cleanroom. And in a sense, what to me at least what makes it interesting is that you're having what on the face of it is an impossibly unlikely event, namely independent creation of two different copyrightable works, which suddenly makes perfectly good sense in a new technology, a different technology than the one the law evolved over. All right. Other questions on copyright? No. All right. So next to patent. And patent, the theory of it is that what you are patenting is an idea. You're getting ownership over an idea, not over a machine. Even though people talk about a machine being patented. And ideas are sort of hard things to define. So the idea might be, if you take this chemical and a certain amount of that chemical and heat them in a certain way and stir them in a certain way and then do this and do that with it, you will end up with a new plastic that is very strong. That would be an idea. That's a method patent. And the idea might be if you construct the following very large structure in an inlet of the sea, you can get electrical power out of the tides. And then probably the idea would have to, since that's a fairly pretty obvious idea, would have to include various features of how you would do it to make it work. That make sense? So in order to get a patent, you are supposed to come up with an idea. You are supposed, the idea is one which is supposed to be novel, meaning that nobody has come up with it before. It's supposed to be non-obvious, meaning that it wouldn't be enough to say you get power from the tides by having a dam in the inlet, letting the water flow in, opening the things of the dam when the tide comes in, closing it when it goes out, and then having turbines. Because that's so much like the way we already get power from dams from rivers that presumably, my guess is, that the patent examiner would say, look, any idiot who wanted to get power out of the tides would do it that way. So I suspect, though I may be wrong, that that wouldn't be sufficiently novel, sufficiently non-obvious to pass. So one way of putting obvious is, if somebody skilled in the relevant art was told to achieve what your idea achieves, could he do it? Ordinary person's skill. Or would it require some cleverness, some inspiration, some new idea? Also, of course, a very real distinction in the academic world, that the people we really, I think, remember and respect are not the ones who did something anybody else could have done if they just were willing to spend 500 hours working through the problem. They're the people, like Coase say, who actually saw something different and new. So it's got to be novel, non-obvious, and nowadays it's supposed to be useful. And I discussed in the book what I thought was a very interesting history of how useful in the 19th century pretty plausibly meant not pernicious. I particularly like the fact that one of the things that counts as pernicious is the device for private assassination. All right, so as long as you're working for James Bond or the CIA, you can patent your assassination device. But if you're only doing it for, you know, wives who are tired of their husbands, then it's not patentable. Then it's not useful by at least that by Story's definition of useful. And in modern patent law, as I understand, you're supposed to go further than that. You're supposed to actually show that it is good for something. And the argument for the old rule is basically, if it's good for nothing, then why does it matter if you have a patent to it? Nobody else will want to do it. Whereas if it's bad, then we don't want to in some way encourage it. And the argument for the new rule, I think, is that we're afraid that people will patent things that are not now useful, figuring that at some point in the future someone else may do the work of discovering a use, and then they'll have a lock on it and be able to charge for that. That's my guess of the theory, though I don't really know what's going on. So novel, non-obvious, and useful. Novel, by the way, oddly enough, not only means that nobody else has done it before, but also that you haven't done it before. And that's a little tricky, but basically, if you think up an idea and you implement it, and a year and a half later you say, I really ought to get a patent on this, it's too late. At that point, you bar yourself because now the idea is out, and therefore you can't do it. And exactly what counts as novel is, again, tricky. And sort of, I think, the theoretical idea is something like somebody who wanted to do it, if he looked hard, could find it. Back a long, long time ago when I was in Chicago, I taught or co-taught at various points courses covering some of this stuff. And I used to have fun making bogus inventions for my exams. And one of them, I have some... I think it may have been the soda machine that could read your mind and tell what kind of soda you wanted. And that was based on a real experience, I should say. That was based on my going up to a soda machine, I think, in O'Hare Airport in Chicago, and putting in my quarters, and it gave me a Diet Coke. And I hadn't pushed any buttons. Which, you know, Diet Coke was what I wanted at the time, maybe a tab. It may have been before they invented Diet Coke. So I had this elaborate story about how the machine could deduce from smelling your breath and watching your eye movements and such what you wanted. And I had some other things like that. I mean, that was one of three or four different bogus inventions for different exams. So one of my exams, I said, after describing this machine in the context of you're a patent attorney and your client wants to know if he can patent this, I said, it suddenly occurs to you that when you were a law student at the University of Chicago 10 years ago, you saw a description of this machine on your final exam. Does this create problems for patenting it? In other words, is it not novel? Because I had described the idea on an exam, even though, of course, I never built any such machine, and it wouldn't have worked in my head. Anyway, but the idea of novel is something like, it's been done someplace people can see it, it's been described somewhere in print, even by you, and there is actually another 19th century case I didn't mention in the book, but it was another fun one, where somebody had come up with some new way of boning corsets, I think some kind of steel or whatever. The boning of corsets is these vertical things inside women's corsets in the 19th century, which used to get out of whalebone. That's what it's called, boning. And he had invented it, he had made it, and he had provided some to the woman who, at least the case describes, his fiancée. And I think it was for a noticeable period of time, so I'm wondering if that really means his mistress. But in any case, so she had used it in her corset for a period of years. And the question was, did that count as public use? And I think the court decided it did, but it struck me as a little bit bizarre, since corsets are not things that are normally visible to the public. But in some sense, it's out there, there or known. But then, in the case of patent, though not of copyright, it is up to the applicant to decide what he's claiming. That in copyright, you just do something and it's there. Patent, you have to apply to the PTO to get your patent. And in applying, you're defining your idea. And you have to do that because the idea is not defined by what you've actually done. All right? If I have some clever idea, let's take an important clever idea, namely the Xerox machine. All right, dry copying, xerography. And Rank Halide, I think, is the original name of the company that became Xerox. And suppose that after 20 or 30 years of effort, and it took a long time, they finally have a machine where you can do what we're all used to seeing Xerox machines doing. And they bring it into the patent office. And the question is, what are they claiming? If all they are claiming is just this machine, sort of like a copyright, then once the machine is out there, you know, 6 months later, somebody else will have another machine using the same principles, tweaking it in various ways, not the same machine, copyright, patent doesn't cover it, we're clear. So instead, they have to somehow define in their patent application what are the features of this thing which they claim are novel, non-obvious, and useful. So in that case, it might be the use of static electricity produced by light to attract particles, which are then fused to paper. I mean, that's part of how the mechanism works. And I have no idea. I've never seen their patent application. It's probably much more elaborate than that. But somehow they have to say, what are the features of their invention, which they're doing? And in order to get a patent, you were supposed to have a reduction to practice, but nowadays, at least, that can be what's called a constructive reduction to practice. A real reduction to practice means you actually built the damn machine, and it worked. Constructive reduction to practice means that your patent application described how to build it in a way such that somebody competent in the relevant art could have done it. I had thought it was the case that constructive reductions were sort of a later development, but I was talking to someone who seemed to know more about it than I do, and he seemed to think that it had been the case for a long time.
Well, it's always been the case that they want to encourage people to go for patents without having to invest a lot of capital, so you don't necessarily have to bring it to market to be able to...
But the question is, as of 50 or 60 years ago, which would be before the time that I knew about, was it normally the case that you had to have a working model that you had done at some point?
Well, there were certain types of classic things like perpetual motion machines and like time travel, things that were obviously like show me kind of things that they didn't believe were true. So there were classic things, but generally there was no specific requirement.
Yeah. Yes. Well, a time machine is quite easy to demonstrate. You don't know that story? Oh, a physics graduate student tells his doctoral advisor that he's described to the time machine. And I'll show you. It takes him into a phone booth. And there on the phone booth, there's this little cardboard placard which has got a speedometer on it, 1 minute per minute. goes into the future. But in any case, so the constructive reduction is the sufficient description so that it could be done. And I believe it is the case that you're supposed to have, that your reduction is supposed to be the best way you know of practicing your idea. Which doesn't, of course, have to be the best way it'll ever be known, but you're not supposed to keep secret the way that really works decently and only reveal the way that costs 10 times as much and does a much worse job. So you're doing two things, really. One of them is you're defining the ideas you're claiming, and the other is you're, in effect, giving an example of an application at one point within that definition. And that example can be a physical example. I discovered, I was looking it up on the web, and apparently until about 1880, you had to literally give a model no more than 12 inches by 12 inches of what you were claiming a patent on. And those were called patent models, but that around 1880 or so, they stopped requiring that. But in any case, if you think about the logic of your claims, you've got a real tension. Because the narrower your claim is, the less valuable it is. If Rank Halide describes in great detail the exact way their Xerox machine works, then it's quite likely that somebody else in more than 6 months, but in less than 5 years, can come up with something fairly close to it, but different enough not to fit under that description, so not covered by the patent. And there's something called the doctrine of equivalence, which basically says if you're too much trying to cheat on it by doing that, we won't let you. But roughly speaking, it's a different way. On the other hand, the problem of making it too broad, if they say what our patent is on is ways of applying pattern ink to a surface from which it is then transferred to paper, well, rubber stamps have been doing that for a long time, so there's no way that you're going to get that patent. So you've got this trade-off between narrow and not worth very much and broad and therefore likely that something, not what you've done, but something within your claim is either not novel or is obvious. All right? And so that's part of the issue. And I mentioned in the book sort of my favorite example of this, which is Morse's sixth claim, where Morse tried to patent the internet and lots of other things. Failed, and I at least claim that the Supreme Court denied it for the wrong reason, that in fact it wasn't novel, quite aside from being overbroad, because light is electromagnetic, and light has been used to transmit stuff for a long time, long before Morse. 1,000 years before Morse, probably longer than that. So that's the basic law. Now, software is an interesting case, because that was actually quite a live controversy for a little while. And the question was whether a computer program was copyrightable. And do all of you know what source code and object code are? I have no idea. No. We're in Silicon Valley, but nonetheless, you've managed to remain innocent of the... Yes. All right. You write a computer program, and when you write the program, you write it in some computer language designed to be usable by human beings, like BASIC or Fortran or Java. That doesn't tell computers to do anything. That is your description of what you want the computer to do. There is then some way, and there are at least two different ways in which it's done, of a computer having a program which will take what you've written and turn it into a machine language code that the computer can run. And machine language, it's just numbers, but it's numbers which involve very low-level instructions to the computer. So that this particular number may mean take the number in register A and put it in register B. And this particular number may mean look at register C, go to the memory location that corresponds to the number in register C, take from that memory location the number you find there, put it in register D. And then another instruction might mean take the numbers in register A and register D, add them together, and put them in register A. It's that level of sort of very, very detailed, picky instructions to the computer to do little things out of which everything else is built. All right. So the machine language is what's called object code. The source code is what human beings can read. And I think it was probably straightforward from early on that if I copied your source code really is a writing. It's written out. Human beings can read it if they know the relevant computer language. So my guess is that there wouldn't have been any question about copying source code being copyrighted. But now, suppose, as in the real case, the equivalent of my IBM story, but a generation earlier. Apple has got a very successful computer called the Apple II. A company owned by a man called Franklin wants to make a clone of the Apple II. They've got the same problem that people who cloned the IBM did only earlier. In order to clone it, they need to have machine language program built into the read-only memory of that machine, part of the hardware, which does exactly what the corresponding code in the Apple II does. Now, Franklin, however, in a sense, appeared to have an easier problem because it had not yet been established that computer programs were copyrightable. So Franklin didn't bother with all of this clean room nonsense. They just copied the silly code, and Apple sued. And then the question was whether machine language code burned into the read-only memory of a computer counted as a writing, since that was what copyright was supposed to cover. And on the face of the answer is it obviously is not a writing. That no human being with his unassisted eyes can read it, or even with a magnifying glass, in order to read it, you got to put the read-only memory somewhere where a computer can get at it and then get onto the screen its content. And when you've gotten it onto the screen, what do you have? You have 739AC61047, which I suppose I'm sure there were a few humans who could read it in the sense that they could say, aha, that first bunch of digits is the instruction to do this, that's to do this, but it was not intended to be read by human beings. It was intended to control a computer. And as I said, Hersey, who was a moderately prominent author and also the head of the PTO at the time, in the course of these disputes, described that machine language program as a fancy CAM. And he said, you know, copyright doesn't cover CAMs. Furthermore, it turned out there was a precedent. Because, you know what a player piano is? A player piano, in a way it's an early computer, you might say. A player piano was a robot piano. It was a piano which had a roll of paper with holes in it, where the holes described what notes to play. And I think the player pumped with his feet, if I remember correctly, to keep the pump going. And as the roll went through, puffs of air went through the holes, and they actuated the keys of the piano. So it was as if there was a ghost of the keys playing the piano, and so it was a way before they had records, tape recorders, and CDs and things, of having the equivalent of recorded music in a lower technology form. And there had, in fact, been a legal case on whether or not you could copyright a player piano roll. And the courts had held that you could not. It was, again, a piece of machinery, not a writing. And so some courts reasonably enough said, we got our precedent. This is not a writing. Franklin, you're just fine. And other courts took the opposite position. And eventually, Congress got involved, and Congress revised the Copyright Act to make it explicit that computer programs were indeed covered by copyright. All right? That's the relevant history. Now, there was a further controversy, which I think probably is still not really settled, about exactly what was covered. And in particular, take the very simplest case, suppose you have a really clever program, and suppose after running the program for a while, I write a program in a different computer language, not actually copying your code, but copying step by step what yours do. So functionally, it's identical to your, not because of compatibility, because you had a clever idea. So I say, all right, aha, the way in which he made this game or word processor work was by doing this, then this, then this, and this, and this, and if this happens doing that, I'll do that too, but I'm writing it in C instead of in BASIC, and I'll look at his code in order to figure out how he did it, but I'm not actually going to copy his code because there are places where I can do it better in my language in a somewhat different way. Is that copyright violation? And I think the current situation is that it is, but it was at least an open question. And you then get into things, I mentioned the Lotus menu tree, but another famous case is the Mac interface. That when Windows comes out, is Windows violating the copyright on the Macintosh user interface on the grounds that it's using very similar things, you know, click on menus, things come down, use a mouse to move stuff around, and so forth. There's this famous quote from Bill Gates, who was pointing out that Apple did not invent the Apple interface, that the Apple interface was really invented at Xerox PARC for the, what was the name of that machine? The Xerox Star, I think, was one of the first ones. It's interesting because Xerox really blew it. That this whole graphing interface that now dominates the computer market, they invent it. they implemented in a very expensive, fancy machine, which is the kind of machine that really people really want to see, can we really make this thing work? And then they never successfully produced it in something that's mass marketable and usable. Apple picks up the idea, and several other companies, Apple, Atari, and somebody else, I think, I forget who it was, all bring out fairly similar machines at about the same time, of which the Mac turned out to be the one that finally went out. I'm not quite sure why, but all of which are using graphic interface. Have any of you ever actually worked for the command line interface? The command line interface is the way computers used to be done, where you did everything by typing in text instructions. As it happens, I knew about the graphic interface before the Mac or before the Lisa. I saw a film showing what Xerox PARC people had done with the Star, and I was really impressed. And that's why, as soon as the Mac came out, I bought one. Because I've been wanting, I've been lusting after this better way of doing it. I'd had a computer before that. Command line interface, personal computer, not a PC, a different competitor. A super clone of the TRS-80, for those who know what the TRS-80 was. A very nice machine. I liked it a lot. My experience with these things was I was visiting at Irvine at a point when Irvine had dedicated word processing system, which I'd never seen before. And the system they used was that you typed your manuscript on a typewriter. You then gave it to the word processor ladies who retyped it into the word processor. They gave you the printout. You marked your corrections on the printout. You gave it back to them, and they put the corrections into the word processor. And I looked at this process, and I said to myself, the productivity of the word processor ladies is negative, because it would be easier for me to type it the first time into the word processor, because word processors are easier to type on than typewriters, because when you make a mistake, you don't have to get correct to stuff and paint it over with white paint and so forth and redo it. And so I got the word processor ladies to teach me how to use their machine, and I came in the evening and wrote a book manuscript. And that was fun. And having had that experience, well, I obviously have to have a word processor. And it turned out that at the time, there were two ways of having a word processor. One of them was to get a dedicated word processor like the one that UC Irvine had. And the other was to get a personal computer with a word processing program. And they cost about the same. And it was pretty obvious what the right solution was. So I got my LNW80, and I never turned back. And after I wrote a book with that, I concluded that prior to the invention of the word processor, no books were written. It's just too much work. But anyway, going back to this subject. So there's then first a controversy over whether software in general is copyrightable, and that was resolved by Congress, and then a somewhat ongoing controversy over just what features of the software count as expression and those are covered by copyright. I was going to say, the comment that Gates is supposed to have made with regard to Apple's attempt to sue him for elements in the Mac interface that ended up in the Windows interface was that what Steve Jobs is complaining about is that after he broke into Xerox's store and walked off of the television, I followed him and took the VCR. And that both of them were really stealing Xerox's ideas, which Xerox was not preventing as it happened. Why, I'm not quite sure. Anyway, so that was the story. Now, that's copyright. Yeah.
Going back to the patent law.
Yes.
One of the reasons behind patent law is you want to give an incentive to people to spend money and
inventing stuff. Right. And the other incentive, arguably, is you want to give them an incentive of having an inventor to tell people about it.
Right.
That's what the word patent literally means. It means open. Letters patent mean as opposed to sealed letters. And it's been used historically in context other than patent law. Yeah.
Every other country but the United States, they have the rule is the first person to file against the patent.
Yes, in the U.S. it's first to invent.
And I guess I can see the obvious reason behind that. One would be lowers the cost of finding out who made it first and filing costs. The other one maybe the incentive to make people bring it forward quicker. Do you see any other reasons why?
I think it's a historical accident. I don't really know. But no, you're right that in the U.S., it's first to invent, and defining when you invented something is not easy. So the theory is, if I thought up the idea today, and I spent the next year and a half working on perfecting it, but I had the basic idea today, and then a year and a half later I go into the patent office, and you went into the patent office the week before, but you had only had the idea 6 months before, I'm supposed to win.
Right.
That's at least the theory, assuming I can prove all of these facts. So that it's, in theory, the person who first invents and uses reasonable efforts from there on to bring it to the point where you can apply. So that, in theory, if I invented it 10 years ago, and I've invented lots of things in the past in the sense of having ideas. I mean, I invented this stuff they use here for taking exams on computers. I invented that 25 years ago, I think, and had a project trying to develop it at Tulane, which sort of stalled and never went anywhere. And I had a better name and made it. I called it Electric Blue Book. But in any case, if I invented it then and worked on it for a while and then abandoned it, I have no priority. If at the point when somebody else had patented that, I had gone in a week later and said, I claim the patent, tough luck. So you're supposed to use due diligence from the time you invent on if you want the time you invent to count for priority. All right? That's the U.S. system. And it clearly is much harder to judge than the European system, where whoever reads gets to the patent office first. On the other hand, you might be worried with the European system that I am working hard on trying to develop my invention. I don't want to rush it to patent because I figure I can get a clearer idea. Maybe I can claim some more territory. I can have a better, best way of doing it and so forth. And while I'm doing it, the rumor of what I'm doing gets out. Maybe one of my lab assistants gossips and some other inventor says, huh, that's a good idea. I bet I could do it too. Does a sort of quick and dirty version and heads over to the patent office and he gets it instead of me. So that would at least be one argument for the U.S. system, but doesn't persuade anybody outside of the U.S., I think. But, yeah, question? No. But that's sort of a distinction between the U.S. and the European system. So far we're talking about copyright. But nowadays you can also patent computer programs. And that's a case where it used to be that the position of the court was that a computer program was inherently unpatentable under what is called the mental steps doctrine. And the idea was that you could not patent something that where what you're patenting was a series of mental steps. So think, for example, of the procedure by which you take the square root of a number, or long division would be a simple example. That if you were the first person to think up long division, the view of the U.S. Supreme Court was you couldn't get a patent on the procedure for long division, or the procedure for doing anything else of that sort. As I read it, at least, and this was, again, 20 or 30 years ago, what you had was a conflict. It used to be the case that appeals on patent cases went to the circuit courts, as appeals of other cases do. And then they eventually created the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which was essentially a circuit court, but to which all patent appeals went. And the theory of that was to avoid forum shopping kinds of problems, I think. But it turned out that the CAFC was a good deal more pro-patent than the Supreme Court was. And so there are a series of cases which I like to describe as the CAFC dragging the Supreme Court, kicking and screaming, into accepting the patentability of programs. And some of those are cases where the CAFC says, well, really the right verdict is X, but we can't give that verdict because the Supreme Court says Y, but the Supreme Court really should have said X. And there are others where they're sort of edging over, and we're not actually patenting your program, we're patenting something which is involved in your program or something. But in any case, at this point, you can patent programs. I'm not sure, again, I'm not a patent attorney, I'm not sure exactly what form you've got to put them in, but in effect, if you've got a series of mental steps that a computer does, you can find some way of getting protection if it's, you know, novel, non-obvious, all the rest of that. One of the things that I find sort of striking is that if you think about computer programs that feel as though they should have been patentable, probably the spreadsheet is the best example I can think of. You have a single brilliant idea, which then you have many implementations of. Almost certainly when the spreadsheet was invented by the VisiCalc people, they would have been told by their lawyer that it wasn't patentable. And the person responsible, I'm told, has been quoted since as saying he doesn't think it should have been patentable. He disapproves of software patents. And certainly in the software world, there are quite a lot of people who think that it would be better if software wasn't patentable because means. They think that basically what's happened is the courts can't really distinguish between something that's non-obvious or obvious, something that's novel or non-novel, because none of the courts know anything about computer programming, and the result is that people get patents on stuff that anybody competent in the field could have figured out for itself, and then when you do figure it out for yourself in some problem you're doing, you find you've infringed their patent without knowing. That's at least the argument. Whether correct, I don't know. But you can certainly see that in terms of a potential problem, that if the courts aren't doing a very good job of filtering out the novel and non-obvious, that you can slow innovation rather than speeding it via intellectual property, and there are people who think that's the case. There are some of the people involved in the field of nanotech, which involves designing things at the molecular level, who at least a while ago, I don't know what finally happened, had a project which was to get anybody who wanted to in the field to put into a database basically everything they'd done and all their ideas, in order that when somebody tried to patent one of them 3 years later, you could say, look, that's not novel, it's been sitting in our database for 3 years. That was sort of a counter move against by people who thought the patent was causing a problem rather than a virtue. Anyway, so that's sort of a summary of the relevant law and the history of relevant law from a not very expert position. And then that gets us to the economic analysis, which was really, I think, implicit in what we did last time. And the starting point, really, which I haven't mentioned, although I mentioned in the book and it's sort of obvious, is the puzzle of why patent and copyright are so different. That they're both exactly the same words in the Constitution, just says writings and inventions, writings and discoveries, I think, is the actual language of it. And yet the law for those two things is quite different. And how do you explain that? And the answer, I think, is implicit in what we did last week and what I've just been saying, that, and I let me push away the question of non-literal copyright, because I don't think that fits my theory very well, so push that under the rug for the moment. But that for literal copyright, you have a form of property that is easy to define sharply. You did or didn't copy my text. You have a form where it is very unlikely to have accidental trespass. And you have a form where the problem of depletion of the commons is very small. People understand what I mean by depletion of the commons. If you imagine there's a wilderness of land out there which nobody is using, and we say the first person who clears some land and settles on it owns it, that's more or less the homesteading kind of rule. That's a great rule if we've got an infinite amount of land out there. But if we've got a fixed amount of land such that at some point in the future we're going to run out, then every time I clear some of that land, I am reducing the ability of other people in the future to do the same thing. And therefore, if the land cleared and belonging to me is worth $100,000, I haven't really increased the wealth of the society by $100,000, and therefore, in a sense, if I have a $100,000 incentive to claim that land, it's too high an incentive. If you imagine that it costs me $95,000 to clear that land or do whatever is necessary to get ownership, the land is worth $100,000, but by getting ownership of it, I've deprived somebody else of a $10,000 opportunity to do it himself. So on net, I've only provided $90,000 worth of benefit, $100,000 worth of land minus the $10,000 loss from there not being the uncleared land for someone else to clear, $95,000 loss to do it, net loss $5,000. Fair enough? All right, so that's the depleting the commons problem. And the argument is that in the case of ordinary literal copyright, you have for all practical purposes an infinite commons. All right, that when I write my book, nobody for a million years is going to write that same book again independently. And therefore, I haven't really reduced your opportunities by writing the book. On the other hand, when I patent the Xerox machine, for all I know, and I don't know, somebody else 3 years later or 4 years later would have come up with the same idea in some different variant. Now he can't, or he can do it only with permission of the patent holder. So the argument is that patents have a problem depleting the commons. Consequently, if you give unlimited ownership of a patent, if any invention, you get long-term ownership, which is what you're doing with copyright, you have way too strong an incentive. Because any invention will include the invention somebody else will make tomorrow or the day after or as soon as they need it. my incentive to make it now is the value of control of it for 50 years or whatever. That's much too high an incentive for many of the things you'll invent. All right, but it's not too high an incentive for copyright. So if that's right, then it makes sense that copyright is given for a long period of time, because it'll be much more than 50 years before somebody else writes my book, would have written my book. And it's given easily, because all I got to prove is that here is a work that I did, and it's distinct. Whereas patent is given, as I like to say, grudgingly, meaning you've got to persuade them that it's novel and non-obvious, which in part means that somebody else wouldn't have easily done it if you hadn't done it. Therefore, your doing it means it's available considerably earlier than otherwise would have been, so it deserves a substantial reward, which patent gives you. But unlike copyright, the normal assumption is eventually it will become invented by somebody else, so we don't want to give you a 50 or 100 or 500-year claim. 17 years is plenty. All right, that's the basic logic, is my claim at least, that you can explain the basic differences between patent and between copyright for literal copying and patent on the grounds that copyright has the sort of features that make private property attractive relative to commons, that patent has much less of those features, and therefore that patent should be given only for large inventions, for very novel, very non-obvious inventions, and should be given for a rather limited period of time. All right? Yeah?
Because it's just to say, you know, like, when you talk about large inventions, or, I mean,
who's
to say that
minor
is novel or large enough to be novel?
Well, patent examiners present the fact, and, or I suppose eventually a court if somebody gets into litigation. But don't you think that in many fields, somebody who is simply a professional in the field could distinguish, when you describe what you've done, could distinguish and say, well, yeah, of course, anybody who tried to solve that problem would do that. And my God, isn't that a clever solution?
Don't you have something like Columbus is A?
Like what?
Columbus is A.
What's Columbus is A?
When you show someone how to do something, then they say, oh, of course it was obvious. That's kind of just the story.
What's the story supposed to be?
The story is that apparently, I don't know the origins of it, but, you know, Christopher Columbus is explaining how he discovered the New World, and he's telling it to a group of people back in Spain, apparently. And he pulls in, when he tells them, it's like, well, of course that's how you do it. And he pulls out an A, and he says, how do you make this A look straight? Yeah, and but then everyone tries it, they don't know how to do it. And, just, and he does that and sets it up, and it's like, whoa. And it's like, well, of course, once you tell someone how to do it.
But what did it do with discovering America?
Well, I mean, I don't remember how he
I mean, the reason Columbus discovered America was he was colossally ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was, I mean, I don't know if you're aware, but this whole business about flat Earth is just nonsense.
Yeah.
It had been accepted doctrine by that time since, what, 100 BC or 100 AD, that the world was round. The Greeks had calculated accurately the diameter of the world, within 5% or so, back again, I think about the first century BC. And what Columbus, the effect in which Columbus disagreed with other people was that he had drastically underestimated the circumference of the Earth, drastically overestimated the difference from Europe to the eastern end of Asia, and therefore concluded falsely that he could get from Spain to roughly Japan. Well, think about the size of the Pacific compared to the size of the Atlantic. He barely made it across the Atlantic. If the New World hadn't been there, he would have died, along with all his crew. So the standard version is just backwards, and it makes him to be the, you know, the guy who had it right. He was the guy who had it wrong, and was lucky. Now, it's possible that he was a fraud. Maybe he knew the New World was there, just didn't want to tell people they would believe him. Various rumors suggesting that somebody else had spotted it earlier, and he was going, at least on the standard story, Columbus was just something who got it wrong. Very, very lucky. There are things like that, certainly. But I mean, I suppose you could argue that that's true of the Coase theorem, or the Coase's whole approach to externalities, that once you see it, it seems pretty obvious, and yet it wasn't obvious for 30 years before that, when people were talking about externalities. But I guess the real answer is that the patent examiner and the courts have to decide if they might get it right, if they might get it wrong, but at least the principle is that they're trying to ask, is this something already known? If it's not already known, is it something which could have been found out easily, or something you wanted to find out? That's a theory.
what I'm claiming is the economics. The economic analysis of property helps give a plausible explanation for why patent law differs from copyright law in roughly the way it does, but it also suggests that the expansion of copyright law to cover non-literal copying may be a mistake. It may be that we should have left that stuff to patent or just left it unprotectable. Notice that an awful lot of stuff is unprotectable. That if you think about shopping malls, for example, or even supermarkets earlier than that, that was an important idea of a way of selling something, but you couldn't copyright it. Get closer. Business method patents now exist, and so maybe if they'd existed back then, someone could have. But it's certainly worth realizing that that intellectual property has downsides as well as an upside, as it were, and it's not immediately obvious whether you're better off with it. And somewhere there's a quote from one of the earlier scholars in this field who said something to the effect that, given that patent law exists, it's hard to argue for abolishing it. And if it didn't exist, it would be hard to argue for creating it. That it really is a case where we can see advantages and disadvantages, and there's no very easy way of knowing what the net is. There is a book, which is, I think, now out, but I forget the title, but I read it in draft because I was commenting on it, by some people who are basically arguing against intellectual property. And I think it's David Levy and some of his co-author, if I remember correctly. And they have quite an interesting account of the history of the steam engine, where they are arguing that patent law slowed the development of the steam engine rather than increasing it, essentially. That the person who got the original patent on it did it through political influence, that there were then a bunch of improvements which couldn't be made because they violated his patent and he wasn't willing to license it, and it was only when his patent expired that the steam engine really took off. But whether he's right, I don't know. It's at least interesting that somebody who's interested in the subject can make a not obviously absurd argument against the U.S. All right, let me go on to software. And my claim there is that Congress got it right. That if the question you ask is a machine language program burned into the ROM as a computer or writing, the answer is obviously isn't. But that's the wrong question to ask. The right question to ask is, why are writings covered by copyright? Why do we have a particular structure of legal rules to cover writings? And if you say, well, the answer is, what are the relevant characters of writings? Expensive to create, easy to copy, easy to tell whether they've been copied, can't copy it by accident, so you know whether you're copying, so costs of enforcing a property system are low, at the same time, because it's cheap to copy and expensive to make, not having any intellectual property is likely to result in not producing much of it because you'll get undersold by the pirates, essentially. So if you take a list of arguments for why you have copyright for writings, pretty much all of them apply to software as well. And if they all apply to software as well, then that suggests that the same legal regime or something very similar that we have for copyright ought to be used for, that we have for writings ought to be used for software. So in that sense, at least I'm willing to argue that in that respect, at least Congress had it right. Again, at least for literal copying, I don't want to try to push it beyond that. Now, there's an interesting case, and again, I'm probably 15 or 16 years out of date on this, so I don't know what's happened since, and that's, there was another form of intellectual property created by state law, where exactly the same arguments apply. That is, where you had something which, like writings and software, was expensive to create but very cheap to copy, and where it was pretty easy to prove copying, and where you wouldn't copy it by accident. And that was the plug hole statute, which I mentioned. And the particular one that I think I discussed in the book was a Florida state law about boat holes. And I gather that the shape of the hull of a boat is a very complicated problem. Think about three-dimensional curves. If you get it just right, your boat will be, I don't know, faster or use less power or won't rock as much. I don't know. I've never done any boat design. And the expensive way to do it is to have some brilliant designer who experiments with lots of things that produces a great boat hull. And the cheap way is for somebody else to have such a designer. You buy his boat hull and you make a mold out of his boat hull. This is fiberglass, probably. And then into that mold, you make your boat hull and you've got a copy of his beautiful design. And so Florida basically made that illegal. And what they really did was to establish a copyright for boat holes. And again, it seems to me that the logic is the same as with copyright, as with computer programs. You have something which have features that make that a sensible form of protection, and therefore it makes sense to have it. However, the federal courts knocked it down, I think, on the ground that it was preempted. Their view was that if you were going to protect these things, you had to do it by federal law, not state law. And there are some federal, I'm not sure if you ended up at the federal level statute. You've got Mask Works Act, which is something similar for computer chips, and I'm not sure what else you have. And there are a variety of other related things. There's the Plant Patent Act, for example, and some other stuff, which I'm not going to talk about, because I don't know enough about it. It's probably not relevant enough. Anyway. Then the final category of this stuff is trade secret. And trade secret, interestingly enough, is a case where the states made the law and the federal government did not overrule it. People know anything about trade secret law? The basic idea of trade secret law is that to be a trade secret, it must be information whose value partly depends on us being secret. In order to claim it a trade secret, you must have done your best to keep, you must have made reasonable efforts to keep it secret. And with one famous exception, trade secret law only gives you rights if the secret has been taken by a wrongful act. So that trade secret law does not protect you against reverse engineering. That's the clear case. If I have an unpatented but very clever invention, and you buy one of them and take it apart and figure out how it works and make some, tough luck for me. Alright? So if I want to use trade secret law to protect something, what I've basically got to be doing is to keep it inside my factory or inside the factory of people who've licensed it for it and agreed to protect it. The rights that it gives you against the person who misappropriated it are basically for compensation based, and there are three different rules, and I don't think there's any clear basis for which one works. One of them is how much his misappropriation cost you, one of them is how much money it made him, and one of them is what you would have sold the secret for to him at in an arm's length transaction. And the different courts, I think, use all three of those rules. And the interesting case, as with some other things, arises with the innocent third party. Let me suppose that my employee walks off with my trade secret. He goes to one of my competitors and he says, look, I'm an independent researcher and I've figured out this really great way of doing X, and I'd like to sell it to you. And my competitor says, it's not very good. You're doing demonstration. Yeah, it seems to work. We'll buy it from you. And we're not going to tell anybody about it because we want to get a good lead on the competition. We're going to build a factory which needs to use this process. And about the time they finish the factory and start going into production, I hear about it. And I say, where in the world did you get this? They said, oh, we found this great inventor named, John Smith. John Smith. Is that the John Smith who used to work in our research lab? And who, of course, signed a confidentiality agreement, not to mention being bound by the normal requirements of loyalty of an employee, etc. Bang, that's a trade secret to a misappropriation. And the law, as I understand it, is that if you haven't built your factory yet, I can enjoin you from using the secret. But as long as you are an innocent recipient, as long as you had no reasonable way of realizing it was a stolen trade secret, I can't make you lose money by tearing down the factory, basically. And again, how that works in practice, you have to ask an attorney. But that's sort of the basic theory. So it's a sort of a quasi-right. It's not, like, patent is not really a property right in a normal sense, because if you discover the secret in some legitimate way, even if I was careless, suppose I give guided tours through my factory, I was foolish enough to leave an open door into the place where people were doing things to reveal my trade secret. Didn't occur to me that one of the people on the guided tour was a retired engineer in the field who spotted the trade secret and realized what it was and went on. Tough luck, I lost it. And I mentioned there's one exception to this wrongful rule, and that's DuPont v. Christopher, which is a weird case, and I don't know whether it stood up since, but that was a case where DuPont had a new process for, I think, making methanol. And they were building a factory in which to implement this process. And some person or persons unknown hired a pilot, Christopher, to fly over their partly built factory and take pictures. And the claim was the pictures revealed the process. And DuPont sued. And as far as I can remember, they never did find out who actually done it, so I don't know what they could actually do about it. But the court did hold that this was a legitimate violation of trade secret, And the court's view is that it is unreasonable to require DuPont to spread a roof over their factory while it's under construction. The plane was not flying illegally. It was up in whatever level of airspace you're allowed to fly over. But nonetheless, that court held that that would count. And therefore, presumably, whoever had blocked the information wasn't allowed to use it. I don't think they were found out what competitor it was who blocked the information. The one who sued somebody. All right, we will go on Wednesday and think about any questions you've got, but also I was thinking of...